This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Welcome back, everybody, to Crimes and Consequences. I have a really exciting story I'm super thrilled to share with you guys.
Ooh, look at you. You are on fire today.
I know. This one's really gruesome.
Oh, boy.
It's really, really nasty. So you all are warned in advance. But it's really interesting, too. So it's not just a whole bunch of graphic, nasty stuff. It's really interesting. I'd never heard anything about it. Have you ever heard of the Grange Gorman murders?
No.
This story is from Ireland. And we've never done a case from Ireland that I know of.
Not that I can recall, no.
So with that being said, I'm going to start as soon as everybody takes 1 second to hit the subscribe or follow button on your favorite app that you're listening to us on right now.
Please.
You ready?
I am.
It's a Wednesday evening, and 46-year-old Anne Marinek was getting ready to go out for a night of bingo and beer.
That sounds like a blast.
Before she left, she was chatting with her two roommates, Sylvia and Mary, who shared the two-story terraced home in Dublin, Ireland with her. Now, I told you before about terraced homes. In the United States, you can think of them as townhouses. These terraced homes were called Orchard View. Orchard View had 5 units, and Anne, Sylvia, and Mary lived in number 1. It was the N unit. The area they lived in Dublin was a northern side suburb called Grange Gorman. Now, Grange Gorman is known in that area for something rather interesting. Its most known feature at the time of this story was that it had St. Brendan's Psychiatric Hospital in that area. And the St. Brendan Psychiatric Hospital, the entrance was right across the street from Anne, Sylvia, and Mary's home. In fact, all 3 women had once been patients at St. Brendan's, and they all suffered from some sort of mental illness. Orchard View was a community-based residential facility meant to sort of be a halfway house for the patients of St. Brendan's that were capable of living more independently. Orchard View number 1, as well as the adjoining number 2, they provided completely independent living accommodations for its residents. But houses number 3 to 5 had 24-hour nursing staff there. Okay, so that's a little bit about Orchard View, Grange Gorman, and St. Brendan's Psychiatric Hospital. Orchard View had no alarm system, no CCTV cameras, and no buzzed entryway. There was nothing but the locks on the unit doors to prevent a sadistic killer from getting in.
Oh.
Anne Marinek moved into number 1 Orchard View in September of 1996, and this story takes place in March of 1997. So she lived there only about 5 months before the story takes place. She first sought psychiatric treatment 25 years earlier when she tried to commit suicide.
Oh.
She was then diagnosed with severe borderline personality disorder. She also had a tendency of self-harm that continued through the years. The self-harm was probably predicated on the fact that she was sexually abused as a child. Now, one of her roommates was 61-year-old Mary Callanan, and she'd been an inpatient in St. Brendan's since 1966. She suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. Throughout her life, though, she was able to maintain a job as a general operator at a shelter workshop. I have no idea what that means.
A shelter workshop?
I don't know. This is Ireland. I don't know what that means.
Don't know what that means.
And she got along well with others. The third roommate was Sylvia Shields. She was 59 years old, and she was first admitted into St. Brendan's Psychiatric Hospital in 1980, diagnosed with chronic schizophrenia and severe borderline personality disorder. Sylvia worked as a civil servant for Ireland until she retired in 1987, so she was able to maintain a job, too, and she lived off of her retirement income. She was described as well-liked and bubbly. All three women got along really well. Each night, they would set the table for the next morning's breakfast, and they always ate their breakfast together.
Oh, that's nice.
I know, that's very nice. They really must have gotten along well. Now, on the evening of March 6, 1996, it was around 7:30 when Anne set out to go to the nearby bingo hall. She drank a pint of beer there, and she ended up winning, which was super thrilled about. On her walk home, she passed by a chip shop, and she bought some chips for her and the nurse from Number 5 Orchard View.
I think chips are French fries.
Yeah, they're a lot like French fries. They sound delicious. And she was nice enough to bring some home. She dropped off the chips to Number 5, and she made it to Number 1 Orchard View at around 11 p.m. Both Sylvia and Mary were upstairs in the bedrooms. When she realized that Sylvia was still awake, she went into her room and she chatted for a few minutes. She was so excited about her bingo winnings. Plus, she had that beer in her, so right. I was just super excited. It was around 11:30 when Anne left Sylvia's room and walked across the hall to hers, promising Sylvia she would wake her up the next morning for breakfast. Anne had difficulty falling asleep, and I'm sure a lot of us out there can relate to that, right? So she would wear her headphones and listen to music on a cassette player when she went to sleep. And on that particular night, she actually took a sleeping aid to help her get to sleep. So she's out. Around 6 a.m., Anne woke up, and she walked downstairs to the kitchen to make some breakfast. As she stepped on the landing, she noticed that her brown purse was upturned on the floor, and its contents were spilled all over. She knew she'd left it on the coffee table the night before. And oddly, there was a light on in the dining room, which hadn't been on when she went to sleep. Stepping into the kitchen, she could feel the chilly spring wind on her through an open window. It was blowing the lace curtains back and forth, and there were particles of broken glass on the floor in front of it. The kitchen's cupboard drawers were opened, and the knife drawer was on the linoleum floor. She noticed a blood smear on a light switch. And with that, Anne totally freaked out. And she hurried upstairs. She wanted to wake Mary and Sylvia and tell them that someone had broken into their house again. Because this wasn't the first time Number 1 Orchard View had been burglarized. Only a few months earlier, somebody broken, but they didn't really take anything of value because I don't even think the women had anything of value. Anne runs upstairs. She rushes into Sylvia's room and she sees Sylvia laying diagonally on the bed. Her legs were dangling over the sides and her feet were touching the ground. She shouted out to Sylvia, but Sylvia didn't move. She approached her, and when she did, she saw a ghastly sight. Sylvia's body was mutilated. It was laying on a blood-soaked mattress. It was really the genital area that had a lot of blood, the mattress below that area. And when she touched Sylvia, she was cold. Fearing for her life, Anne ran down the stairs, out the front door, and onto the street. She was hyperventilating.
Oh my God, I don't blame her. Jeez, what a scare.
Her hands covered her face, and people around her didn't really know what to think because she couldn't even talk. Anne ran towards Number 5 Orchard View, and that is one of the units that has a full-time nurse on staff. The nurse came out and tried to help Anne, but Anne, again, she couldn't get the words out of her mouth. She was beyond hysterical. She was overcome with shock. Eventually, the nurse was able to understand enough to know that Sylvia was bleeding and she needed help. The nurse summoned a doctor and two security guards from St. Brendan's Hospital, and the two security guards went to check on Sylvia and Mary along with the doctor. Anne was actually taken to the hospital and treated for shock. When the security guards and the doctor went into Number 1 Orchard View, they found Sylvia laying on her bed. She was wearing only her bra and a black slip, which had been pulled around her chest, exposing her breasts. The leg opening of a pair of pants was around her left thigh, and the remainder was hanging almost to the floor. Blood was everywhere. And so you can understand how this house is set up. Mary and Sylvia's rooms were adjoined. There was a door between them. with Mary's room being the room closest to the front of the house. The guards opened Mary's room to check on her. They need to see, you know, what the hell is going on with Mary. And at first glance, it appeared that it was empty. But as they were walking out, one of them spotted two legs on the floor sticking out from between the bed and the window, which overlooked Grange Gorman. However gruesome the scene was for the two guards and the doctor when they saw Sylvia, it didn't compare to what happened to poor Mary.
Oh, no.
The nurse summoned the Bridewell police station, and they ended up dispatching some officers, and the state's pathologist came to the scene. The pathologist, his name was Dr. John Harbison. Normally, when he would go to a crime scene, he would have this running commentary while observing the scene, talking about this and that and what he sees. But this time, he was unusually quiet.
Probably because he's like, what the fuck? Right?
Oh, yeah.
Ugh.
Analyzing the crime scene, it was clear that Sylvia was the first victim. And you'll understand why in a few minutes. Her body had been slashed and mutilated repeatedly both before her death and after. Her throat and neck were cut over 10 times.
Oh.
A serrated carving knife had been used to make lines back and forth over and over again on her forehead. Her right breast had a very deep gouging stab wound in it. Another knife had been thrust in and out of her chest wall twice.
Oh, no.
I haven't even started. It's so awful. There were two prong puncture wounds all over her body made by a carving fork.
Oh, man.
And there was a clear sexual component to the murder. Her genitals were mutilated. According to the source for this story, which was the report of the Commission of Investigation, and I'll get into that, Sylvia's genitals were, quote unquote, severely maimed. Her clitoris had been cut off.
Ooh.
Part of that genital mutilation included the use of a carving fork.
Oh, no.
In her room, buried in some clothes, they found a steak knife. Its blade was bent. Under her bed, authorities discovered a serrated carving knife, and that blade had been bent 180 degrees.
Oh, my God.
Now, as awful as Sylvia's injuries were, I told you, they were no match for 61-year-old Mary's. She was found lying on the floor wearing a blue floral winsette type nightdress. I think that's how you pronounce it. Do you know what that is?
Mm-mm.
That's what I would consider a muumuu.
Okay.
An old lady gown.
Yes.
Something I'm probably going to buy in the next 2 years. That was gathered around her chest, exposing her underwear. An electric carving knife was found on top of her her neck. And another one was found on the floor next to her. She had a slipper on her right foot, but it was missing from her left. There were severe facial injuries, including a knife wound through the mouth and the lips across her whole cheek. The injuries to her face were made with the blade of the electric carving knife, and they were so extreme that she wasn't recognizable.
Oh, man.
Her face was, like, carved up. A bloody shoe print was on her chest from her killer stomping on her with his foot. That resulted in multiple broken ribs. Her throat had 36 knife wounds to it. Some were described as tentative, like the killer hesitated when he was making those slices, and others were deep. Her chest had numerous puncture wounds from the carving fork and stab wounds from the carving knife. Her left breast had been punctured with a carving fork, and her right breast had been partially amputated.
Mm.
It appeared that the killer was trying to do a full amputation, but for whatever reason ended up stopping. All of her injuries were from electric carving knives and carving forks.
Oh, my God.
Which were from their kitchen. This is where it gets real bad.
Oh, there's more? Oh, no.
A red object was protruding out of Mary's vagina, which was extremely difficult for the most seasoned detectives to even stomach. In fact, one of the detectives that was processing the scene, he ended up resigning after it.
Are you kidding me?
Because it's so horrible.
Oh, my God.
It was only during her autopsy that they were able to determine what this red object was. It was the handle of a carving fork the carving fork had been so forcefully embedded in her pelvic bone.
No.
That the fork prongs had formed a barb so that it was just incapable of being removed manually. The only way they could remove this carving fork with a red handle was to surgically take it out.
Oh my God.
Isn't that crazy?
It is awful. What the fuck?
What the fuck is that?
Oh my God, the force?
The whole carving fork.
Oh my God.
Was there. I told you, so bad. It's so bad.
Is she alive when this happened?
I don't know. I think that's really hard for them to determine because there were so many wounds. They know some she was alive for, some she wasn't. I'm hoping she wasn't.
Oh my God.
I think as I tell the story, you'll probably get the same feeling I have, that she was probably dead by the time the fork was forced in her.
Oh my God. Okay.
As I told you, Sylvia also had puncture wounds from the carving fork. So that's how we know that she must have been the first one injured, because Mary's the one that ended up with a fork inside of her. Neither woman had any defensive wounds on them, and the cause of death for both of them was shock and hemorrhaging. It's estimated that they died between 11:40 p.m. and 1:20 p.m. And you have to remember that Anne said goodnight at 11:30.
Yeah.
The pathologist I was telling you about, Dr. John Harbison, he later described the scene as carnage. Extensive amounts of blood splashes were on the walls, the beds, the furniture in both those bedrooms. And once he was outside of number one Orchard View, he turned to the detectives and the investigators, and he said, "What we have just witnessed in that premises is outside of my experiences of 20 years of crime scenes and the examination of the injuries inflicted on one human being by another. It's more than I've ever seen."
Wow.
To this day, it is one of Ireland's most gruesome crimes, right? I mean, it'd be really hard to top that. The crime was beyond anything the Bridewell Police Station was capable of handling, so they asked for assistance from the National Bureau of Criminal Investigation, NBCI. Together, the two law enforcement teams spent 11 days examining the crime scene, but they weren't able to recover any blood from the killer, no saliva, no semen, no hair, no other fibers that might lead them to the person or persons that did this. But they did find something really chilling. In Anne's bedroom, on the inside of her door, was a smear of blood. There were blood smears on the carpet in front of Anne's bed, and some blood stains at the end of her mattress. Whoever slaughtered her roommates had crept into her bedroom and stood over her as she lay sleeping.
Oh my God.
Yet for reasons unknown, he let her live.
I was going to say.
Well, I know why. I'll tell you guys out later. Oh, how creepy is that?
That's extremely creepy.
She was so close.
If she had just, like, opened her eyes.
It's a good thing she had those headphones on and that Ambien or whatever the hell she was taking.
Oh, my God.
This is what investigators surmise happened that night based on all the evidence at the house. There was a four-pane window near the kitchen. The unknown intruder, he must have broke the bottom glass pane and then physically removed some of the pieces by hand, because they found some on the outside placed on the ground and then some on the inside. But he must have cut himself when he was pulling himself up inside the house, because there was a little bit of blood on the window sash. After entering the house, he stepped on a garbage bin that was below the window, and then he jumped onto the floor. There was evidence of glove marks on the inside of the bottom lower sash window frame. He entered the kitchen and he opened three drawers, the last being the drawer that contained a cutlery tray and loose knives. Put that on the floor, was rummaging through it, and grabbed, as you know, a whole bunch of carving knives, electric carving knives, steak knives, and a carving fork. He then went upstairs and to the right at the top, that's Sylvia's bedroom, and he attacked her by stabbing her in the chest. And then they believe that he threw her legs over the bed, and that's when he began the mutilation. Through the shared doorway in her room, he went into Mary's. She had to have been awake, because it appears as if she climbed out of bed. Because you remember, she was found on the floor. Mm-hmm. Here she climbed out of bed, but he had to have attacked her, obviously, before she made it too far. Then after the murder, he went into Anne's room, stood over her, and then for whatever reason, walked away, went back down the stairs. He ended up going into a fourth bedroom that was empty, and they know that because they found a partial footprint made in blood on the carpet. That print was from a caterpillar boot. Then he found blood on the light switch. He headed towards the front door, removed the chain, and walked out. That's how it happened. The investigation was painstaking. It involved the taking of more than 1,000 statements. They went house to house, door to door. They researched the background of Mary and Sylvia and Anne just to see if there was anybody who might conceivably have any sort of motive for this crime. But no matter what they did, they didn't come any closer to finding the killer. Who would want to kill these women?
Right.
They had very structured, simple lives. They followed a routine, and they didn't really, I guess, besides bingo, I don't think they socialized a lot. Ultimately, the police engaged in the services of an experienced profiler in Britain. And on April 14th in 1997, there was actually a couple people that worked on it, and they submitted a preliminary suspect profile. This is what they came up with as far as what they believe the killer would be like. He'd be a male, right?
No, of course. Sorry, but yeah.
One offender in his mid-teens to early 20s. He was likely to be socially isolated with only a few friends, probably lived or worked close by, lacked social skills, and they thought he probably didn't have a lot of sexual experience. In fact, this is kind of weird. In their profile, they said the lack of experience either made him unaware or afraid of inserting his penis into the victim's vagina.
Huh.
Unaware?
Unaware. Like you don't know how it all works?
I guess. Like you don't know what's going on.
It's 1997. Come on.
He had highly developed, brutal fantasies of overpowering women and mutilating their dead bodies. And I mean, I could have probably came up with that in the profile, I'm just saying.
Yeah, you're not knocking me out with some crazy
information that they discovered. But they did say it would consume him. These fantasies would consume him. He became sexually aroused from the injuries he inflicted on the victims once they were dead. And it was very likely this was his very first serious offense, given the number of hesitation and exploratory injuries inflicted by him. There are a lot of injuries, by the way, that I didn't get into because I didn't know how much was fact and how much was fiction, but there was discussion of him attempting to cut out parts of the women. I don't know how much of that is true. They surmise that he probably committed a prior burglary and had worked himself into this killing.
Damn.
They believe it's likely that the victims knew their killer. He had a poor work history. He had average to high intelligence, but was an underachiever. He felt no remorse. And lastly, the offender was extremely dangerous and was likely to reoffend. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for cluing me in.
Thank you, Captain Obvious.
Right? A patient in St. Brendan's Hospital gave the police a description of a male whom he'd seen lingering outside the hospital a day before the murder. Not the day of, a day before. He described him as 6'2", about 35 to 38 years old, very slim, had a black mustache, and was badly dressed as if the clothes did not suit him. So they made a computer-enhanced sketch of this likely suspect. But 3 months later, the police were no closer to solving the crimes. A long list of suspects had been compiled, and the investigators were painstakingly seeking to eliminate these individuals one by one. They went through 265 people.
Wow.
And you know how these people became suspects? There was a variety of routes, but basically people would just call in and be like, you know what, my neighbor, he seems like a perv.
Really?
Things like that. They looked at the backgrounds of anybody that had been involved in violence or sexual perversion. They looked in the background of people charged with burglaries in the Grange Gorman area. So it was a matter of individuals, the police, prisoners, and professionals working with disturbed or violent people that called in the names of the people that the police looked into. I like to know the professionals that work with disturbed or violent people. What kind of job is that? Sounds pretty interesting. At the time, Ireland had a national news service called the RTE, which had a program called Crimeline. This show featured the murders of Mary and Sylvia twice in the months that followed. And then they released that sketch. So they got a tip by a man who'd been burglarized months earlier, and you got to follow me on this, by another man named Peter. Peter was questioned, and he recalled an incident in which he was hanging around a group of homeless people in the Dublin 7 postal district, which is a known area for people with troubled lives, such as drug abusers and homeless people. According to Peter, he was hanging out talking to a group of homeless drug addicts, and they were talking about the murders when a man named Dean Lyons became very defensive. And that really stood out to Peter. They questioned another person that Peter said was there during the strange conversation with Dean Lyons. And that person said he recalled Dean saying something about raping grannies.
Oh, no.
Police felt like this might be their first lead. And so they interviewed 24-year-old Dean Lyons. He was homeless. He was a drug addict. He'd been using heroin for about 4 years. Dean was the fourth of six children. I'm just going to tell you a tiny bit about him. His parents, their names were Sheila and John Lyons. And they really loved and they cared for him. But at an early age, they realized there was something different about him compared to his brothers and sisters. They took him for testing, and it showed that he had a full-scale IQ of only 70. He had trouble, obviously, with school, and as a teen, as I said, he became addicted to heroin. His parents kicked him out of the home, but he still maintained a really close relationship with them. They really, really wanted to get him help, but if he couldn't get the help, he couldn't live with them. But they still talked to him every day. Dean only had a history of petty crimes like theft, nothing significant, no history of violence. His group of homeless friends, they thought he was odd. And they basically only kept him around because he was really generous with his drugs. He was just kind of strange. When the police went to talk to Dean, he was at a local hostel staying. He ended up going in and willingly speaking to the police. At first, it was very casual and light. They're just bantering back and forth. And he denied having any involvement in the killings. But he couldn't recall where he was that night. And I don't blame him. I mean, he's addicted to heroin, right? And he's homeless. So it's like, I'm sure every day kind of blends in. It does for me.
Dude, if you asked me what I did on, you know, January 3rd, I'd be like, I'm not sure.
If you asked me what I did this morning, yeah. I don't really know.
Last week was a blur.
I woke up. That's about it. That's all I remember.
I know I did some work.
I did something.
I did something.
So anyway, I can't blame him for not knowing what he did on the night of March 6th, early morning of March 7th. But after a while of talking, Dean's demeanor changed. It wasn't this light bantering back and forth. He started crying very softly. When they asked him if he was all right, was there anything he needed to get off his chest, he blurted out, quote, I killed the two old ladies. I'm so sorry.
Oh.
End quote. He claimed he was in the process of burglarizing the house when one of the women heard him and just began attacking him, so he had no choice but to kill her on the landing. That's what he said. It was at the landing. He killed her. He couldn't remember how he entered the house. He didn't even know what weapons he used to kill them. A lot of the details he provided didn't match up with the crime scene. Obviously, you caught on to that.
Mm-hmm.
When he would describe what he did and he was incorrect, the police would say something like, oh, you mean the bedroom? You killed her in the bedroom. And then he would say, oh, yeah, that's where I killed her, was the bedroom. And this went on for days. A lot of the officers had their doubts about Dean for reasons it's obvious, but a few senior officers were convinced that he did it and they wanted to go forward with the case. And after a few days, Dean made basically a complete confession. I have part of that complete confession. This is what he said he did, okay? Quote, I smacked her in the face with my elbow. She went out. I pushed her off the bed onto the floor. She was lying on her back facing me. I sat on top of her. I meant to tell you that I stuck the steak knife into this woman, but I'm not sure where I stuck it. Anyway, when she was laying on the ground and I was sitting on her, I put my left hand over her mouth to stop her from breathing. I think she was alive because she was breathing heavy and gurgling. Cut her throat with the electric carving knife blade. I pulled up her nightdress and I pulled off her pants. I also took off her bra. I started to cut off one of her tits. I think it was a left tit. I don't know why I did this. I only had a small cut on my hand after using the electric carving knives. They have no handles, but there was this white clip thing that I could put my hand on to get a good grip. End quote. So that's what he says. When Dean's parents find out about his arrest, they immediately go to the Bridewell station. They were beside themselves in grief. It wasn't because they thought Dean did it. It was because they knew he didn't. Dean had this long track record of making up stories that were wholly false and being able to tell them in a really convincing manner. He'd been doing that since he was little. For example, as a child, his dad had a heart attack. And Dean, while at school, feigned a heart attack.
Oh, no.
And he was so convincing that the staff truly believed he was having heart problems.
Seriously?
On another occasion, he claimed to have injured his back, and he was taken to the hospital via ambulance. When the ambulance arrived and they pulled him out of the back on a stretcher, he jumped off the stretcher. He was totally fine. There was nothing wrong with him. And on yet another occasion, he was with a friend who got caught shoplifting. Dean claimed up and down that he was the one that actually stole the item. He was persistent with the lie, and it was only when the security guards or whoever they were showed him the CCTV footage of his friend stealing it that he admitted he was lying.
Wow.
His parents were furious, and they demanded that Dean admit that he was lying about committing these murders. His dad said, "You're going to ruin our family." I mean, obviously, right? Nobody wants to be associated with that.
Yeah, nobody wants to be the parents of the murderer who killed two little old ladies.
Yeah.
Brutally.
Brutally. But Dean was adamant that he did it. He told anybody that would listen to him that he did it. And the prosecutor pursued the case against him, and it was going to go to trial. Before the trial, Dean was given psychological testing by a psychologist, and it showed he was abnormally and exceptionally suggestible, and that he had an abnormal tendency to give in to leading questions. As a matter of fact, he scored in the 95th percentile for basically being easily manipulated.
Oh, great.
And you have to remember he has an IQ of 72.
Right.
The psychologist stated that he did not believe that Dean had anything to do with the murders, and that he just was seeking attention.
Oh, that's really sad.
It's really weird.
Yes,
I mean,
it
this
is
way, I mean, I get wanting, everybody wants a little attention now and then, but not for this.
You're right.
But the prosecutor refused to dismiss the case, even though there was no evidence linking him to the crime. Dean's confession didn't match the scene, and the psychology testing indicated there was a high chance he was lying about it. But the prosecutors and police would soon change their mind about Dean when another gruesome double murder hits Ireland later that year in August. But before I tell you about that crime, we're going to take a quick break. Okay, we're back from our break. Months go by as Dean is awaiting trial, and he, again, is telling anybody and everybody that he killed Sylvia and Mary. Meanwhile, 28-year-old Catherine and her 29-year-old husband, Carl Doyle, were living a very simple life in a small cottage in the countryside of Ireland with their four young children. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about Catherine and Carl Doyle, because it's all connected. They were high school sweethearts who grew up in Dublin, but for years they'd been saving up their earnings so they could purchase their modest dream home, which was northwest of Dublin in a county called Roscommon. And it's in bumfuck Egypt. That's where they moved to. They bought a rambling two-story farmhouse 5 miles outside of Castleria and a very tiny village called Carron. Population 60.
Wow, that is small.
That is very small. Carl got a job as a butcher, and Catherine stayed at home with their four children. They lived a simple life, and they loved it. They were described as hippies at heart. They were set to renew their vows in the church on November 25th of 1997, but neither one of them would live to see that day. August 16th was a Friday night, and Catherine was really excited because her younger sister, Sarah Jane, was taking a train from Dublin with her boyfriend, Mark Nash, and two small children to visit Catherine and Carl in the countryside. 19-year-old Sarah Jane had met Mark 5 months earlier at a club, and they really hit it off because they both had a couple things in common. They just ended relationships in which they had babies out of that relationship. Sarah Jane had a 5-month-old son, and Mark had an 11-month-old daughter named Ella. So you've got Sarah Jane and Mark and these two babies, and they take this train from Dublin out to bumfuck Egypt, and they arrive about 8:30. Carl picks them up, and they stop at a liquor store on their way home. They're going to get some ale, whiskey, vodka, and pop.
Nice.
They're going to have some fun. It's Friday night. By 9:30, Carl and Catherine had put their 4 young children upstairs to go to sleep in the bedroom. Sarah Jane and Mark's babies, they were sleeping on the couch in the living room, and there was like more couches and some chairs. And the adults had all gathered around a drink. They were smoking some weed, and they were just having a good time, right?
Nice.
6 kids. Damn. By the way, 6 kids.
I'd be smoking weed and drinking too.
Under the age of 7, right? Oh, yeah.
It's a lot of babies.
It's a lot. By all accounts, Carl and Mark had gotten drunk. Mark was so drunk that he ended up puking in the bathroom.
Oh, no.
Where he stayed cuddling the porcelain god for quite a few minutes, probably at least 15. Carl passed out on the couch opposite where the babies were sleeping. Meanwhile, Sarah Jane and Catherine, they went upstairs where the other kids were sleeping. They started putting some sheets on the mattress because they needed to bring the little babies upstairs. So they're basically making some beds up. And it was in the same room where Catherine's 7-year-old son, Jesse, lay with his 5-year-old brother, Frank. So they're making these beds, they're putting like sheets on them, and they hear the stairs creaking. They don't think anything of it. Then Mark appeared in the doorway holding a metal object. It was a tool that was used to open a fuel cap on a Stanley range. You know what a Stanley range is? One of those old stoves, Stanley range. Mm-mm. Anyway, it's a heavy metal tool. He's standing there in the doorway and he's holding it. And then he runs up and pounces basically on Sarah Jane. And he's pounding her in the head with this metal bar. She tries to cover her face with her hands, but the blows just keep coming. And she could feel her own blood dripping down her face. Mark was screaming at her that she had to die. He was saying it over and over again. Catherine tried to protect her sister by jumping on Mark. And she did end up pulling him off Sarah Jane. That's the last thing Sarah Jane remembers before blacking out. She regained consciousness a few minutes later. How long? Nobody really knows. And when she did, neither Mark nor Catherine were in the room. But 7-year-old Jesse was holding his 5-year-old brother, Frank, and they were both crying. They were trembling in fear. Sarah Jane's trying to come to. She's stumbling towards the stairs. And Mark must have hurt her because he ran up the stairs and he began beating her again. She fell to the ground and he was bashing her legs with this heavy tool. She cried out to him, "Why are you doing this?" And he just laughed at her and pushed her down the stairs. He followed her down and he stood over her and he hit her over and over again with that metal bar. Ended up causing a depressed fracture to her skull. Sarah Jane went quiet. She quit screaming. She decided to play dead. And it worked because Mark walked away from her. Once he was gone, she realized, I have to do something. There's this house filled with kids and this fucking psycho. So she gathered her strength and she crawled through the kitchen, out the back door, through some tall grass to a shed. And she hid from Mark.
Oh, my God.
And this grass is very tall. It's like a field. Realizing she was gone, Mark came outside. And this is so goddamn creepy. He started calling out her name in a sing-song manner. Oh. Sarah Jane. Sarah Jane.
It's like a horror movie.
It really is. He was walking around the back garden looking for her, doing that Sarah Jane. He came so close to her that she was sure he could hear her breathing because it was so heavy. In a calm and very kind voice, he told her, "If you come out and come back into the house with me, everything will be okay."
Sure. Don't fall for it, girl.
But when she didn't respond, he flew into a fit of rage and he just began running around the property yelling for her. Eventually, he jumps over this ditch and runs into a surrounding field. And he didn't come back. He left behind his own 11-month-old daughter, Ella.
What the hell?
Sarah Jane knew she had to figure out how to get help for those kids inside, but her legs were just battered. She ended up dragging herself a quarter mile to the nearest neighbor's house, the Hester family, who in turn called the police. The police entered the house through the back door, and immediately they were greeted with the sound of crying children. I mean, you have babies awake.
Oh, man.
You have a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 7-year-old, a 13-month-old, an 11-month-old, and a 5-month-old. In the dining room on the floor next to a Stanley stove, they found the battered body of Catherine. She had 16 stab wounds to the head.
Wow.
Made from a boning knife.
Oof.
There are also indications that she'd been strangled, but the coroner ruled that she bled to death on the floor where her body was found. Oh. Her husband, Carl, he was found sitting up on the living room floor against a wall, his head tilted to one side. He'd been stabbed at least 4 times in the chest, and the tip of a boning knife was still embedded in him. His cause of death was he slowly bled out. Police found a second boning knife, the weapon that was used to kill Catherine, in the backyard, close to a bloodstained wood pile. Sarah Jane was taken to a Beaumont hospital where she was treated for severe head injuries. Upstairs, little Jesse was still holding Frank. They were hysterical in the bedroom, and they also had their 3-year-old sister, Holly, and 13-month-old sister, Heather, with them. All the kids were now orphans. So let me give you a little bit of background on Mark Dash. He was of African Caribbean descent. So police figured it wouldn't take long for them to catch up with him in the countryside of Ireland. I mean, he would stand out a little bit. He was born in England in 1973. After high school, he mixed with some criminals and drug dealers. He was charged and convicted in 1990 of assaulting a woman. He ended up moving to Dublin with his girlfriend before he met Sarah Jane and his newborn daughter in October of 1996. But he kept cheating on his girlfriend. So they broke up only a few days after Sylvia and Mary's murder. And a few weeks later, he met Sarah Jane. After Mark was arrested, he stoically described the murders of Catherine and Carl to police. But imagine their surprise when he started talking about Sylvia and Mary's murder. This is what he said, quote, "I cannot explain my mind at the time, but everything seemed to turn black. I lost control and decided to break into a house. I went in a side entrance to the back of the house. My mind was disturbed at the time. You have to understand that," end quote. I think I fucking understand that. Yeah. I got that.
No shit.
Earlier that night, he'd been drinking and playing trivia with some friends at a pub. He was walking home, and he says he just decided to break into Orchard Number 1.
Huh.
He went in. He saw Sylvia sleeping. He pulled down the covers and stabbed her in the chest. Then he did all those things he did to her. He made his way to Mary's room. Her light was on, and she was getting dressed. He attacked her, as you know, and before leaving, he took the long 2-pronged fork and, are you ready for this? Quote, "stuck it into her vagina. I had thumped it with my open palm, like hammering a nail in. So I got it right up there."
Oh.
End quote.
Oh, God.
So gross.
Gross.
So gross. But why did he spare Anne?
Yes, Talia, tell me, please. Why did he spare Anne?
According to Mark, he entered Anne's room with knives still in hand with the intent of killing her. But as he approached her, he began, quote, "regaining control of himself and stopped."
That's wow. Why That's why?
He regained control. Took a while.
Yeah, no shit.
He estimated that he was there from about 12:30 to 1:30, and then he fled the scene. He says he went home, he took a shower, and he spent the rest of the night crying.
Oh, shut up.
He disposed of everything he was wearing that night except for his black velvet jacket and caterpillar boots. Police confiscated both items, and they found 2 small particles of blood on a button and a sleeve of the coat. But the sample size was too small for any sort of real testing in 1997. Dean Lyons, he was released from jail. And he eventually died of a heroin overdose in 2000.
That's sad.
Mark was tried for the murders of Catherine and Carl Doyles, and he was given 2 life sentences. So because he was behind bars, investigators really wanted to wait for science to advance to try to test those tiny particles of blood, and they knew he wasn't going anywhere. While he was in prison, Mark wrote Sarah Jane.
Oh, fuck him.
Multiple letters of apology.
Oh, my God.
He said the world doesn't need a person like him in it.
No, it doesn't.
He said he couldn't explain his actions, but to say he was a madman. That's about accurate. As advancements in technology grew, forensic scientists were able to test the blood samples found on Mark's coat, and one ended up matching Sylvia's, and the other matched Mary's. It would take 18 years for the prosecutors to try Mark Nash for the murders of Sylvia and Mary, but they did, and they ended up finding him guilty, and he was given 2 life sentences. Mark's daughter, Ella, she grew up believing that her father had abandoned the family, and she didn't know who he was.
Oh, that's crazy.
She found out when she was 14.
Oh, shit.
And she had a lot of problems.
Yeah, she did.
When she found out. She ended up drinking a lot.
Oh.
She's better now. She did this interview, and she's quoted as saying, "I really do think he's a monster."
Oh, that poor, poor girl.
Right?
How fucked up to find out your dad did this horrible crime.
Horrible.
Oh, man. I'd rather just think he was abandoned us, right?
Right? So it sounds so much better.
Yeah.
That'd be dad. There was a lot of very angry people upset about what happened with Dean Lyons, because in retrospect, it's so obvious he had nothing to do with it. They actually did, I don't know how to describe it, but what I would call an inquest into how everything went wrong. And it was 140 pages long.
Damn.
It was really interesting, though. And that's where I got most of the information. It was called Report of the Commission of Investigation on the Dean Lyons Case. It's really interesting. And that's the story.
Is a life sentence in Ireland?
I'm pretty sure it is.
Pretty sure it is for him, right?
Yeah, at least for him. I didn't look into it all. And Damn. There's a lot of crazy side articles. There's this big fan he has that, I don't want to say fan, a friend. She visits him all the time and says he's not a monster.
Oh, shut up. Come on. So that he had to have been convicted just recently, right?
Yes.
Yeah, like within the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, I think it was 2015.
Yeah. Wow.
And I'm sure this is a big story in Ireland, but I had never heard anything about it here. And you know, a lot of the ones we do are gruesome.
I know. I'm surprised we didn't hear this one. Because usually those are the ones that get a lot of attention.
And I'm sure it did in Ireland.
Damn. Well, thanks for that, Talia.
I'm so thankful all of you who took the time to listen to this story and listen to us. We know you have choices.
No, you have choices.
If you haven't done so already, I'd like to ask you to hit that subscribe or follow button on whatever app you're listening to us on. Also, check us out on our social media. We have Instagram and Facebook. The handle is
@HardcoreTrueCrime.
Hardcore True Crime. Also, you can go to our website, crimesandconsequences.com. We post photos of the cases that we do. You can also see what kind of merchandise we have. You can even listen to our episodes there. We have some online-only episodes for your listening pleasure on the website. And if you want to help support us and get ad-free early releases of public episodes and over 170 exclusive episodes, check us out on either our website or go to patreon.com/TNTCrimes or subscribe to our Apple channel.
Through your Apple Podcast app.
Which I don't have.
I do, and it's very easy. Click a button. You know, y'all know if you have an Apple phone how easy it is to buy shit. Just do it.
If you have an Android phone, keep it. Apple sucks. Apple sucks.
But it's the same episodes on our Apple channel that are on Patreon.
Yeah.
So.
Anything else?
Nope.
Check us out at CrimeCon.
Yeah, y'all. Come see us at CrimeCon.
We will be on Podcast Row.
So check it out. And it's in Vegas. I mean, do you really need another excuse to come to Vegas and have fun?
True crime in Vegas?
True crime and Vegas.
Oh, hell yeah.
So come.
It's going
to
be crazy.
If you decide to do it, come see us.
That's it.
That's it. Thanks, Talia.
Till next week, don't kill each other.
Bye.
Bye.